You're listening to an SBS News podcast.
Putin wants legal recognition for what he has stolen.
Russia is not winding down its military machine, but ramping it up.
I've been called much worse than a despot, so it's not that insulting.
It's all so absurd and completely unserious.
Welcome to World News Weekly. I'm Katrina Stirrett, joining you from Sydney, and I'm reunited with Claudia Farhart in Jakarta. No better way to stave off post-Japan holiday blues than with a chat about the glorious state of global affairs, Claudia.
Yeah, look, I had grand plans to welcome you back, Kat, but I still haven't received the matcha you promised me.
I should not have made any commitments there. And speaking of commitments, plenty of back and forth this week over a US peace plan for Ukraine, plus a notable absence from another major summit.
Yeah, also this week, the stormy end to COP30 in Brazil. What did the Last Chance Summit actually achieve? And is a new bromance blooming in Washington, D.C., Kat? Stick around until the end of the pod for the camaraderie absolutely nobody saw coming out of the White House.
There is a lot of noise in the media, a lot of political pressure, and even greater responsibility for the decisions ahead. Putin wants legal recognition for what he has stolen, to break the principle of territorial integrity and sovereignty. And that's the main problem.
Ukraine's president there, who has made it clear he's prepared to sign a peace deal, but not at any cost. There's been a flurry of diplomatic activity after the US's 28-point peace plan was leaked to the media, ringing alarm bells in Kyiv and Europe. It was seen as being overly generous to Russia, with caps on the size of Ukraine's army and a demand that Ukraine hand over the entire Donbas region, even the bits it still controls.
The Ukrainians demanded to meet with the Americans and did so in Geneva, where alterations were made to the peace plan. It seems Kyiv and Washington both believe the framework of a deal is done, but the thorniest issues will be resolved between presidents. Then there's the issue of what Moscow thinks. Our chief international correspondent, Ben Lewis, is keeping across events and joins us now from London. Good morning, Ben. Let's go back to the beginning here. How did this new peace plan actually come about?
Hey, Claudia. So to explain that, I need to introduce you to a bloke named Kirill Dmitriev. He's the head of Russia's sovereign wealth fund and an emissary of sorts of Vladimir Putin. He's recently become one of his closest advisors. He's also Russia's most prominent internet troll, declaring himself a peacemaker and regularly mocking Americans who support Ukraine and mocking Europeans for pretty much everything. He was given a sanctions waiver to visit Miami last month. Who lives in Miami? Steve Witkoff, Donald Trump's old friend and special envoy, as well as Jared Kushner, who is, of course, Trump's son-in-law. Fresh off the Gaza ceasefire, they decided to try to solve the Ukraine situation, and that's how the 28-point peace plan came about. No surprise that the contents were totally unacceptable to Kyiv, from giving up the 12% or so of the Donbass they still control, to altering the Ukrainian constitution to rule out NATO membership, to the rather vague promises of American security guarantees. Essentially, it was basically a Russian wish list. The US Army Secretary Dan Driscoll was dispatched to Kyiv, and he essentially told the Ukrainians, now's the time for a deal. You're going to lose this war. Otherwise, it's not going to get any better than this. Driscoll is an old friend of US Vice President J.D. Vance, who's been quite critical of Ukraine in the past. Now, the Ukrainians demanded talks with the Americans following this, and they got their wish, meeting with the Secretary of State Marco Rubio in Geneva, where the 28-point plan was reduced by several points and tilted a little more in Kyiv's favour. Rubio is generally seen as being much more critical of Russia than most in the Trump administration.
So, Ben, the Ukrainians have now had a chance to put their input into the plan after that Geneva summit. What do we actually know about the proposal now?
Kat, not a great deal, really. There are far fewer points now, as anything to do with NATO or EU membership has been removed, because both organisations essentially said, look, membership is a matter for us. It is understood Ukraine has accepted the fact there will likely be a cap on the size of its army. The latest reporting suggests 800,000, which is probably something Kyiv can live with. It's not that far off the size of their armed forces at the moment during wartime, and it would still be the largest fighting force in Europe besides Russia. The big issue, that is land concessions. Now, that has not been addressed yet, and both the Americans and Ukrainians agree that's something that needs to be determined at presidential level, meaning a meeting between Zelensky and Trump, and we know those can go off the rails. Zelensky has said he's ready for that meeting now. His team even suggested visiting Mar-a-Lago on Thanksgiving. But Trump has said he'll only meet with Zelensky and with Putin when the deal is final or close to it.
A deal between Ukraine and the United States is one thing, but it means nothing if Russia doesn't sign off on it. What is the Kremlin saying?
Well, exactly. And Russia's made it very clear they prefer the original 28-point plan. No surprise there, given they had a hand in writing it. The revised proposal on which Ukraine has had input, as well as the Europeans, will almost certainly be rejected by Moscow. Yet it's important to remember here that Russia never actually said it would agree to the original plan. Vladimir Putin had just said it was a good basis to start discussions. The reality is Russia believes it's winning on the battlefield, or at least that is the impression they're trying to give Donald Trump and the Americans. Therefore, it's in no rush to sign a peace deal. Stringing the Americans along is a bit of a Russian specialty. And that's why so many US lawmakers who support Ukraine, even Republicans, are calling for Trump to levy new sanctions to put the pressure on Moscow, not Kyiv.
And Ben, the fighting obviously continues. What's the latest on the ground?
Look, it is tough for the Ukrainians, but there's no sign of an imminent collapse on the front line. The Russians are making gains into the city of Pokrovsk, often entering the urban streets on foot or motorbike. It's just how this war is being fought. Drones in the sky, small units on the ground. Russia is also getting closer to Kupiansk. The Russian Defence Ministry has claimed at times to have control over both cities. Ukraine denies this. The truth is probably that both are still being fought over somewhat. Russia continues its near-nightly missile and drone strikes, often hitting residential areas. Ukraine is still targeting oil and gas facilities inside Russia, again with nightly drone strikes. So, in short, the war grinds on and the weather is getting colder, meaning it will be even harder for either side to make any progress in the coming months.
Ben, thanks very much for joining us.
I now say that this gavel of this G20 summit formally closes this summit and now moves on to the next president, which is the United States, where we shall see each other again next year. The summit is therefore closed.
That was the very unorthodox ending to a very unorthodox G20 summit in South Africa. The summit is supposed to end with a ceremonial handover to the next host, but there was one problem. The next host is the US, and it chose to boycott this year's meeting altogether over Donald Trump's widely discredited claims of a genocide against white South Africans. The US tried to send an embassy official for the handover, but South Africa said that would be insulting. So in the end, Claudia, it was just Cyril Ramaphosa and his gavel.
Yeah, and that kind of summed up the whole summit, Kat. This was the first time the US had ever boycotted, and its absence sort of cast a shadow over the whole thing. But it did seem like Ramaphosa and perhaps some of the other world leaders were a little bit keen to seize on that. Trump's team had been pressuring a bunch of the other countries not to sign the usual joint declaration that comes at the end of these things. But with the exception of Donald Trump's good friend Javier Milei of Argentina, not only did all the other countries sign the declaration. They signed it on day one of the summit for the first time ever. And that seemed to be a clear message to Washington that the rest of the world can crack on without it. Probably the biggest proof of that is what's actually in the declaration itself. So it calls for a commitment to the Paris Climate Accords, which Donald Trump withdrew from after repeatedly calling climate change a hoax. It calls for a shared commitment to open trade. Well, that's while Donald Trump's tariffs have single-handedly wrought havoc on global economies. And it has repeated calls to urgently remove barriers to gender equality, which has become a dirty word in Trump's White House. So not only did they defy Trump's pressure to not sign the declaration, they also seem to make it a clear rejection of a lot of what he stands for.
Yeah, the US is accusing South Africa of weaponizing the G20 and says it's going to restore legitimacy to the group at next year's summit, which, somewhat ironically, Claudia, is going to be hosted at one of Donald Trump's golf courses in Florida. Boycott drama aside, Cyril Ramaphosa tried to put the focus on poorer nations at this year's summit, saying he would place the priorities of Africa and the Global South firmly at the heart of the G20 agenda. He did have an ambitious agenda going into it, and this included securing help for countries recovering from climate-related disasters, reducing their foreign debt burdens, helping poor nations harness their own critical mineral wealth, all in an effort, he said, to combat widening global inequality.
Yeah, and while the 120-point joint declaration sort of expressed support for all of those issues and more, analysts say it didn't really attach any timeframes or targets to any of them. So whether it's actually going to lead to any real change for those poorer nations or if it will just end up being some more nice words on paper is going to be another issue altogether.
Well, COP30, the make or break COP build as the last chance to get back on track before we overshoot the runway, has come and gone and left a decidedly despairing taste in the mouths of climate activists. The lack of any US delegation or even any US media was dismissed before the summit as being unable to derail the coalition of the willing from forging a path to a fossil fuel-free future. Unfortunately, the fossil fuel producing countries did just that, with no mention of fossil fuels in the final communique.
So to help us answer the questions, what, if anything, was achieved, and is COP even capable of doing what it says on the tin, is Associate Professor Paul Reed from Charles Sturt University. Thanks for joining us on the pod, Paul.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So, Paul, was anything of serious note achieved at this summit?
We had two things that were achieved. One is that we're moving towards a set of indicators that will eventually give some teeth to climate change mitigation and adaptation. And the other is that we at least increased adaptation funding by tripling it to $1.3 trillion. However, that's to be spread out over a number of years. And the deadline for delivery of that was spread out to 2035, so that's 5 years later. So clearly that's going to have an impact on the amount that's delivered per year.
For 30 years, Paul, we keep expecting COP to do something it appears to be incapable of. Isn't that the definition of madness?
Absolutely. It's mutually assured destruction. And we've had 30 years of dithering. In fact, we've had more than 30 years of dithering because it was actually 1982 that James Hansen first, the scientist James Hansen first, raised the possibility that carbon emissions were putting us on track to raise global temperatures. If we compare what we've done over the past 30 years since the Conference of the Parties began to what was done for the ozone layer in the 1980s, the ozone layer problem was raised in 1985. By 1987, they had a solution, and by 1989, the whole world agreed on acting to repair the hole in the ozone layer. Now, we haven't completely done that, but at least we had 5 years, and we were able to come up with a solution that the entire world agreed upon. At the moment, we've spent since 1982, and certainly over the past 30 years of COP meetings, dithering over an issue which is far more challenging and far more dangerous than the hole in the ozone layer.
Yeah, I mean, unless the fossil fuel sort of largest fossil fuel emitting countries sort of change their tracks, it seems like we're sort of going to continue down that path. How do you think we overcome that?
Well, that has been the problem all along, because most of the petrochemical states, and Australia is included in that, those are countries which rely on their standard of living and the running of their economies entirely on the basis of digging up and either exporting or burning within their domestic boundaries fossil fuels.
So, Paul, would a possible solution be simply cutting these carbon emitters from COP, because everyone else seems willing to put forward a solution?
No, I don't think so, because that puts us in a very difficult position globally. We do have economies that are being run on energy. And we as a species have adapted to the point where we've got 8 billion people on the planet relying on the agricultural systems and the water distribution systems and all of the other systems that all rely on energy. We also have the additional problem of species loss, and this is huge. We're at the moment, the extinction rate is 70 times the extinction rate of the last mass extinction. There's normally a natural extinction rate. It's 1,000 times greater at the moment than the natural extinction rate. So we have a species crisis, we have a plastics crisis, and we have a carbon emissions and methane crisis, all converging, and none of them are being properly addressed in the way, for example, that we did in the 1980s with the ozone layer.
So, Paul, just how bad is it looking?
The most recent research demonstrates that we're most climate scientists, and I say climate scientists, predict that we'd be heading for an increase of 3.5 degrees on average global temperatures. That's on top of average global temperatures by 2100. However, there are about 12 different models that are all used to test what's going to happen in the future, and some of them predict 3.5 as early as 2038. The global insurance industry has done its own work, and this is the reinsurance giants. These are the insurance giants that insure the insurers, and they have worked out that if we hit 3 degrees, everything becomes uninsurable. That means whole economies cannot be insured, everything from your property to your businesses. If we hit 3 degrees in 2038, and the global insurance giants are saying that everything becomes uninsurable at that point, then we're heading for something fairly catastrophic a lot sooner than 2100.
A lot to work out ahead of COP31 by the sounds of things, but thank you so much for joining us on the pod today.
Thank you very much.
Donald Trump says he's planning to visit China in April after an unexpected phone call with President Xi Jinping on Monday. It's unclear who initiated the call. Both sides described it as a good call, but gave different accounts of what was discussed. Trump's team saying they covered the war in Ukraine, fentanyl and US soybean exports. But Chinese state media is saying Xi pressed him on Taiwan, telling him the island's return to China is an important part of the post-war international order.
Yeah, the timing of this call is going to be noted by Taiwan because it happened while the US is piling the pressure on Ukraine to make territorial concessions to Russia, which Beijing will be watching closely. It also comes off the back of weeks of tension between China and Japan after the Japanese Prime Minister, Sanae Takaichi, said that a Chinese attack on Taiwan could trigger a military response from Tokyo. But after his call with Xi, Trump also spoke with Takaichi. She told reporters afterwards that he briefed her on that phone call with Xi and told her that she could call him anytime. So it seems like everyone is trying to get the US president on side over this one.
and citizens of Myanmar are the latest to bear the brunt of US President Donald Trump's immigration crackdown. The administration has announced plans to terminate its temporary legal protection program for them, saying the country was deemed sufficiently safe for its citizens to return. That's despite the fact there is a civil war raging in the country, resulting in some 1.5 million refugees and asylum seekers fleeing the country.
Yeah, the Secretary of Homeland Security, Kristi Noem, cited the military junta's upcoming elections, which she referred to as, quote, free and fair, as evidence of improving stability in Myanmar. That drew immediate outrage from human rights groups across Asia, who have long dismissed the upcoming vote as a sham designed to legitimise the junta's rule. No genuine opposition groups are allowed to run, and the junta has made criticising the vote punishable by death.
Israel has killed a senior member of the militant group Hezbollah in one of the first airstrikes on Beirut, Lebanon's capital, in months. Haitham Ali al-Tabtabi was Hezbollah's chief of staff, who the US had designated a terrorist and imposed sanctions on in 2016. Lebanon's health ministry says 5 were killed and 28 injured in the attack. It comes as Israel escalates its campaign against Hezbollah, despite a ceasefire which came into effect last November, claiming the group is trying to rebuild its military capabilities.
The Lebanese government has vowed to disarm Hezbollah, but says the army needs more resources to do so. Lebanon's president, Josef Aoun, condemned the attack and urged the international community to put pressure on Israel, which continues to occupy at least 5 locations in southern Lebanon. And just last week, Lebanon's president said the country was willing to re-enter negotiations with Israel if they halt their continuing airstrikes.
24 schoolgirls have escaped after they were abducted from their predominantly Muslim boarding school in northwest Nigeria last Monday amid a spate of recent mass abductions in north-central Nigeria. On Friday, 300 students and staff were kidnapped from a Catholic school in the state of Niger. 50 of those students have also reportedly escaped.
No one has publicly claimed responsibility for the latest assaults, and while the attacks are indiscriminate, they follow a similar pattern. Gangs known as bandits arrive, shoot sporadically, abduct victims, and flee to nearby forests. Security experts say the attacks are motivated by money, with poor security making schools easy targets, and it's forced the closure of all primary and secondary schools in Niger State.
Are you affirming that you think President Trump is a fascist?
I've spoken about...
That's okay, you can just say yes.
Okay.
It's easier. It's easier than explaining it. I don't mind. And I've been called much worse than a despot, so it's not that insulting.
You referred to Mr. Mamdani as a communist.
I mean, he's got views a little out there, but who knows? I mean, we're going to see... But I just want to congratulate. I think you're going to have, hopefully, a really great mayor. The better he does, the happier I am.
So that was, of course, US President Donald Trump repeatedly standing up for New York City's progressive Democrat Mayor-elect Zoran Mamdani during what turned out to be one of the stranger media appearances at the White House on Friday. Despite the media's best efforts to get a rise out of the two of them, the pair were perfectly polite throughout, even sharing a laugh. And at one point, get this, they gave each other a little bro bump on the arm, Claudia, when the press couldn't get the better of them.
We love a bro bump, Kat. My favourite headline out of all of this was from Politico. They said, Trump, Mamdani, make love, not war. Sums it up perfectly, I think. I know we shouldn't be surprised by anything anymore, Kat, but none of this made any sense. Before last week, Mamdani was calling Trump a despot and a fascist. And here's just some of the things Trump had said about Mamdani. Quote, a 100% communist lunatic, a total nut job, and my personal favourite, he looks terrible, in all caps, his voice is grating, he's not very smart. And now, all of a sudden, a love fest the likes of which the White House hasn't seen since the heyday of Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency.
Ah, we do remember that bromance fondly, don't we? And one of the theories about what might have been behind Trump's change of heart here, right now his biggest problem at home is the cost of living crisis, and that's really where Mamdani won his election. So his team might have done the math and figured it's safer not to pick a fight with him right now.
Yeah, another theory I've seen around, if there's one thing Donald Trump loves more than a suck-up, it's a winner. And even though the two are about as far apart on the political spectrum as it's possible to get, Mamdani won big. So we now have a situation, Kat, where Democratic Party heavyweights like Chuck Schumer and Barack Obama still haven't come out and publicly shown him any support, but Donald Trump has.
Wild times, wild times. Who knows? Maybe this will turn out to be the political love story we need to heal our deeply divided world.
I personally cannot wait for the next chapter, Kat.
Me too. And that's The World this week. If you're enjoying the pod, be sure to like and subscribe. New episodes drop every Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.
And speaking of love fests, a big thanks to the team of producers behind World News Weekly. They are Nick Ludlam, Ali Cheevers and Billy Dellenberg. And thanks to you, Kat. This was fun. Let's do it again.
Let's.